say it, honourable member.
Can you deal with that?
Thanks, honourable chair. Maybe just one.
Sorry, chair, but my other question has not been asked.
Thank you, honourable Groenewald. General, is there any questions outstanding?
May I deal with the other questions, and I'll get back to that one. I know specifically which question is not dealt with, honourable chair.
Okay.
Maybe just one thing relating to the Auditor General's finding. It is a finding, and we have to correct that situation. There were no records in that Limpopo office, and it has to be corrected, because you can't have an inconsistency in an environment. The process of ensuring that there are proper records has been initiated, and it will be one of those, honourable chair, that we will follow through in the implementation of the audit recommendations. I think the unrealistic targets have been spoken to by a number of honourable members. We will, as we said yesterday, in the strategic session that we go into during November, review the targets, including that which Honourable Ramatlakane referred to as a multi-year target, which is not supposed to be in the annual plan. It will be migrated, and if there is something that could be reported to on an annual basis, it will be done, but it need not be in the annual report of the department. I'm not sure whether when we asked about the JCPS coordination, we wanted to talk about the ACTT, because in as far as the JPS structure is concerned, it's functioning well. We meet on a monthly basis. I am a co-chair of that session. We have got the DGs presenting themselves there. We, as and when we are to call extraordinary meetings, we do so. If we don't meet at the JCPS, we meet after having activated the net joint structure, which is specifically dealing with issues relating to operations or challenges that we will find. So, there is no issue with the JCPS structure. I am the co-chair, and I think we meet on a monthly basis. That's how we engage. We did as the JCPS DGs cluster deliberate on the outcomes of the SCOPA, and we have issued some directives which we hope in our next meeting we are going to be presented with a report and corrective measures to ensure that we are on track, because as the general correctly indicated, it is not all, but some of those DGs that are sitting on the JCPS cluster that are supposed to be sitting or represented in the ACTT. From our side, the National Head DPCI, the Divisional Commissioner Crime Intelligence, and at this stage the Divisional Commissioner Detective Services will be sitting on that, so that we are doing what that structure demands from us. The issue relating to the buccal swabs, the training there, at the end of March, 20,127 members have been trained. 20,127. As on the 28th of September, 22,707. And of these 22,707, 70% of them are detectives or those that are responsible for investigation. Honorable members will recall that the focus was on the investigators first, and then we are going to progress towards training the first responders, in other words, those in the crime prevention environment and so on. In this 20,000, you will also have investigators from IPIT that has already been trained. Honorable Chair, the issue that you have raised of Belleville, the office accommodation, that matter has been escalated with the Department of Public Works together with Supply Chain Management. They are working on it. It is not the only DPCI building which is a challenge. There are some others, but having raised the issue with me, we did what is required to make sure that we engage. It's not one of those devolved buildings. That is why we are to be working together with the Department of Public Works in this regard. I think I've covered all except the one. General, can we just deal with the question by Honorable Groenewald?
Honorable Chair and the Honorable the question is, was there any communication between the President and myself?
No communication between myself and the President. No communication. I investigate cases, and after finishing, I'm taking the cases to the prosecuting authority.
Right, colleagues, let's go to the second.
Sorry, Chairperson.
Sorry.
No. It's not that simple. So can I ask then, for the General, doesn't he think that the fact that it is the Minister of Finance, member of the Cabinet, high profile, that at least he should have contacted with the President? It's nothing to do with the investigation as such, but I mean, it's got huge implications if you do something like that. How is it possible that there could have been no contact with the President?
See, two other hands. Let's get the hands and then we'll give a response opportunity. Honorable Ramatakane, Honorable Molebatsi.
No, Honorable Chair, the Honorable Groenewald's question perhaps is an important question, but asked the wrong place. Because the decision of prosecute or not to prosecute is a decision of another competent authority. In this case, it will be the Minister of Justice. The decision of that lies there. So I don't think that we could try and get the water out of the stone here. Well, it's a correct question, I think, but it should be asked to the relevant minister. In this case, the Minister of Justice will be appropriate person to answer that particular question, because the decision to prosecute is not the police decision.
Maybe, Chairperson, just to say, Honorable Groenewald must also stop looking at this thing as this a minister. He must at least look at it as a citizen. He's a citizen of this country. Just like any other person, when a citizen must answer for some things, so he must just stop looking at it as a minister of a cabinet. Thanks, Chair.
General Bahlane?
Chair, we have noted what has been said, but I think it is safe to say that yesterday, when the National Director of Public Prosecutions communicated the decision to the nation, that he had said that after the decision was taken, he had informed the Minister of Justice. And I think he was doing that to ensure that a cabinet minister is able to engage with the president if that was required. But I think once the summons is received by the Hawks, all what was required is execution. But I suspect we may be the wrong people to answer the question as to whether the president was informed or not. If we, for example, informed our ministers, it is incumbent of them to liaise with the president if the need arises.
Right, let's go to the second round. I just want to come back to the findings of the AG because it's quite critical. I think we also highlighted yesterday, it's important that the portfolios that we are responsible for, there must be improvement. We must deal with those issues. But the issue of performance information, because there's also a finding with relation to the value of amount involved in procurement fraud and corruption cases, there was not sufficient audit evidence. And so subsequently the amount that was eventually included in the annual report is only 36.2 million. So it's again about systems, good control. So I just want to get an indication from General Lameza and maybe the National Commissioner, what steps have been done to ensure that you address that issue? Because again, it's a question of command and control. Of course, there's been some changes in your provincial commanders or heads. But is it an issue that's getting the necessary attention? Because on the one hand, I mean, it gives then a skewed picture. You could have then maybe made have successes of 200 or 300 million rand, but you're not able to show that. So that is just maybe a major issue because it affects your target. So if we can just get a comment on that specifically in dealing with that. And then General Lameza, when you appeared last time before the committee, we raised our concern about the issue of the rate of filling of vacancies, because that have got an effect on your targets. How do you deal with that? So is there any progress since your last appearance in the committee with dealing with the targets? Other members? Honourable Mbele, Honourable Ramatlakane?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. My first question actually links to the last one you ended off on, because I was looking at the HR management section of the SAPS report, and unfortunately those tables aren't disaggregated to isolate the DPCI relevant information that I could pick up in the same way that the performance indicators are. But for example, if you look page 270, it indicates there were about 1,100 vacancies in the Detective Service Division. That's a rough figure I'm arriving at. And then if I recall correctly from the last engagement with General Ntlemeza, there was an indication of about 700 odd vacancies in the DPCI. So the bulk of the Program 3 vacancies are made up of the DPCI. And the indication given at the time was that the filling of those would form parts of the creation of the two announced units once the work study is done, and we remember that whole process that was outlined. So I just wanted to get an indication from the general where do we stand right now in the filling of those vacancies, and whether those have been frozen pending the work study and the unit's creation, or is there scope to, you know, move towards capacitating or boosting the capacity in that regard, given a media story that I saw, for example, a few weeks ago, indicating that there was the one investigation where there was one Hawks investigator, but in others there's more investigators, and so just the unevenness of the approach sometimes seems certainly unfair on one investigator who has to handle quite a large and complex case. It was the Prasa case, as I recall. And then my second question, Chair, is that in terms of Section 17J of the SAPS Act, as part of Chapter 6A, there's the establishment of an operational committee which is chaired by the national head, and is meant to meet four times a year. It involves a whole bunch of people from the SAPS, and basically plays the role of plays a coordination role, which should help alleviate the challenges raised in the indicator earlier around the JCPS cluster. So can I just get a confirmation if this operational committee, the Section 17J committee, is in fact established? Is it meeting at least four times a year as it should? And what kind of issues is it dealing with? And is it doing so effectively in terms of having the buy-in and the active participation of the relevant of the relevant stakeholders, noting in particular that one of the stakeholders is the Commission of SARS. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ramatlakane, then Honourable Molobatsi.
No, Chair, just a small follow-up on the previous question on page 128. I know that General Demenza says that if you look at this trial-ready cases, you can actually say you have achieved the target, because the calculation downwards, if it's 30, you will say 6. Now, I want to just to ask, that's the evidence of what has been achieved in terms of the trial-ready docket in that column that suggests 18. Does it not suggest to you that the 30 target over 5 years was completely under-targeted? So I would want to try and understand that if you're going to do the revision of the target, you should be using your baseline as the reasonable, achievable target. But you can't now go to the lower side of the target when you look at the 30. Do you know if you say this one, you've inherited this one? There may well have been an error that 30 was meant to be annual, that whoever was a writer of that particular aspect, something crept in that writing of the MTF, so it then make it multi-year instead of 1 year. So why would you want to interpret it to the easy part of the target, the lowest part of the target? Because I want to interpret that to the error. The 30 is correct as an APP, as an annual figure, and not necessarily then. What is wrong is what crept in the multi-yearing in terms of writing. So what's your comment to that? Because remember, we always worry about under-targeting. That you see low target, then you come here, you say, hallelujah,
I've overperformed. So I just want to say to you, Chair, that I think that my interpretation of this is actually 30, not the 6. It's 30, but what crept in is in the writing of the multi-year site aspect of it, because the evidence here shows contrary to the 6. Thank you, Chair.
Molubatsi?
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. Can you refresh my mind? I know this question has nothing to do with DPCI, but it has, it's still a subs question. Can you refresh my mind on this grooming camps that are part of the recruitment framework? Thanks, Chair.
Right, I get an indication, members, is that a lot in terms of the, I think the arrival of the lunch might have an impact here, but any more questions? Right, let's go to the responses. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, thank you very much. The question of Honourable Molivati on the grooming camps. We remember when we presented the new basic training program, we have reviewed the grooming camps. So the grooming camps are no more part of our process. And maybe immediately let me deal with the question, the last question of Honorable Ramatlakane. As we undertook, we are going to review these targets. But you are correct. When you look at this 30, it's supposed to be over that five-year period. So if you take the 30 over the five-year period, it's supposed to be a lesser number. I think you spoke about six per year. But it may be very low, because already performance, actual performance, suggests that we have we are already on 18. So while the multi-year target, we are not going to tamper with it, we are just going to migrate it out of here and now have an annual target. Now that annual target will be informed amongst others by the baseline, which is the 15-16 performance. So we will review it as such. We will interrogate it and check, for example, what are the factors that possibly positively contributed to the realization of the 18. If that 18 is not a mountain, then it is the basis on which our annual target is being set. If it means that in year 3, we have already met the 30 that we were supposed to have met over a five-year period, we will pronounce as such. So, Honorable Chair, the target will be reviewed, but we will not disregard the baseline in this regard. Then there was also a question. I want to deal with the question of the filling of vacancies and the vacancies in the DPCI environment. I think, Chair, it is important that the following is noted. And somewhere earlier you did ask the question, or the question was asked in respect of what is supposed to be the focus of the DPCI level 3, 4, and 5. And the general is correct that we will, where the need arises, collaborate, draw the resources to even focus on other matters where we need capacity. But as we speak, the capacity that was to focus on level 1 and 2, which was supposed to be in the detective environment, was incorrectly moved into the DPCI environment. Now, that migration process that we're talking of is a process aimed at moving that capacity back into the detective environment together with the dockets that they were carrying. In other words, those dockets that are not supposed to be in that environment are to move to the detective environment.
Sorry to intervene, but General, I assume it also takes into consideration the two new units. You, you, oh, yeah, 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 okay.
that will take care of those new units, because you can't simply go and you have moved people together with dockets to DPCI. The dockets that were not supposed to be in the DPCI because of the level. Now, you can't simply go and move the dockets and leave the people, because the capacity is going to be a challenge. So in doing so, the need to have the new units established is going to be there. So that in itself is going to change the picture in, with regard to the vacancy rate, because there are some people who are going to remain, because remember, we work here on a fixed establishment, that the numbers that were there, when we talk of, I think Honorable Mbele mentioned 700 or something, if you take that vacancy, it is not a vacancy only in relation to to investigate 3, 4, and 5. It is the broader capacity of the DPCI. So that is going to be impacted. But I think we were to have completed this process already. Had committed ourselves to complete it in this by the end of this month in terms of the relocation, and it will become much more clearer in terms of where we are going with regard to the vacancies. That said, it is not stopping the DPCI environment from continuing to fill posts. Posts continue to be advertised where, for example, there are those critical shortages that need to be addressed. That is why I think we are now in the main. I think the for example, the management posts have in the main been filled. We know that we have got all the provincial, what you call the provincial aides, DPCI, they are in place. The senior management posts are filled. The lower level posts continue to be filled in that process.
Really a follow-up on that response.
Chair, if I may, just a very quick, small follow-up. I'm trying to put things together in my, to make things gel in my head, and this is part of the difficulty and the complexity created by the very convoluted process that leads us where we are now in terms of the DPCI, because firstly, just to understand if I'm correct, that the fixed establishment of the DPCI is part of the Program 3 fixed establishment, which I would assume so, because, you know, it's all structurally there. But then at the same time, you've got, Section 17DB says that the national head determines the fixed establishment of the directorate. And so I would hope that there's consultation and coordination to make sure that in the fixing of the DPCI fixed establishment, there isn't an undercutting of Detective 3, although it's kind of the one thing within the other. So can I just get some clarity on, especially because of this issue of the migration that's underway, which suggests that there was an initial an initial defective process in the creation of the DPCI posts, which is now needing to be fixed with this migration. So there's a lot of complexity here that needs to be sorted out. Over and above the fact that the DPCI's monies get defrayed and appropriated by Parliament from the SAFS budget, can I just get some clarity on that, please, Chair?
On the same issue.
Thank you, Chair. My last question on that is on the multidisciplinary investigations. How often do you use prosecutors? Because that was actually part of the success of the previous Scorpions, that you involve a prosecutor with the investigation. And do you then ensure that that specific prosecutor, if you involve him, that he or she then is a prosecutor in the case?
Thank you for those questions. Members, we will ask the General to respond to that after lunch, 20 minutes. It's now 1 o'clock. We will reconvene at 20 past 1 for the responses and further questions. 20 past 1. Thank you.
I think the coffee is to your satisfaction.
At this stage,
anything
I'll take
will do.
What I can get.
I see.
Well,
then we have to go over, definitely. Where are they meeting?
I think it's 4, 5, 4, so on the fourth floor of this building.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Thanks for that one.
Yeah. Apparently, we didn't want to let Lynette Breitenbach to be part of the meeting because she's going to implicate the NPA method.
It never stops. It never stops. Is Mr. Barclay around, please? It's Norbert Stern and Roberts. Oh, I see. I've left a message on his answering device at home under 553-3874. We were hoping for the liquor license application that we could meet up at 11:30 on site in Harrington Street tomorrow morning for 15 or 20 minutes. Oh, yeah, if it's not Mr. Barclay, perhaps his companion or whoever could just meet up with us. 11:30 tomorrow at Harrington Street 1045B. 104B. Thank you.
How are you?
Mr. Douglas? It's Norbert Turner, but I'm fine. Listen, I left a message on Mr. Barclay's private answering device of 3874. Any chance to meet up tomorrow for 15, 20 minutes on site at 11:30? Perfect. Okay, then we'll have to meet up on the CCID and myself. Okay, super. See you outside the premises. Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye-bye. Yes, thanks. Super. Look forward to that. Bye-bye. So, let's see. But I am coming back at some stage. There we go.
Hat mal denn die Welt,
Hammer. Ja, du.
Carbon Pagerado.
Thank you.
Oh, Mark's building at 2 o'clock, 314.
What's happening there?
Continuation of what does.
Oh, okay.
There were sparks flying, but I don't know what those sparks. Huh? How's the coffee? Do you have satisfaction? What? You haven't. Are you joining us at Justice, or are you staying here?
I have to say, unfortunately.
There we go.
Because Kian Hazen got involved.
Hmm?
Kian Hazen, the chief whip, came to the meeting and objected to the way that Breitenbach was being treated.
Yes, he was in. He was in the meeting.
Was Kian Hazen in the meeting?
Huh? What?
They're continuing at 2 o'clock at 314.
And this question about the Olympic track suit. Have you been following that?
Well,
hilarious.
I don't know generally about this.
Yeah, in the meeting, court. Members said it was outrageous, the tracksuit
was. Very bad.
Be the most popular person in this room right now.
Get out of here, Paul.
No, I'm sorry. That's my job.
And Monique, how ironic that.
Quite.
I'm leaving this place. I'm going over. It's more exciting. There are sparks flying, hopefully. There were no sparks here.
I don't know. I mean, as we finish this,
right, members, 2 minutes, 2 minutes. Members and delegation, we need to continue. We're currently busy with the responses from SAPS with regard to DPCI. I think we've still got the issue to do with forensics, and then we'll have to go to program 4 in terms of our timelines. So we'll allow now the SAPS to respond to the questions before lunch. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, thanks very much. I think let me clarify the follow-up by Honorable Mbele. The very first thing to be placed on record here, Chair, is that you will not have any funds relocating from the DPCI into the detective environment, because that's money solely reinvested for the DPCI environment. Secondly, when we talk about the migration, maybe simply put, you will be talking of the function which is not supposed to be performed within the DPCI environment, but within the detective's environment where it is funded for. If you take the numbers which are currently in the DPCI, that is dockets and people, you have got more, you have got dockets there, cases there, which do not fall within the scope of the DPCI mandate. It is those that we say they are to be relocated back into the detective services environment. Then, when the DPCI was established, you had people coming from the Scorpions. At the same time, internally, you had components within the detective services environment, which is your organized crime and your commercial crime, that were already there investigating cases. But those two components were then abolished from the structure of the detective services they were taken to the DPCI. Now, we are simply in this process of migration, because one of the things that we were confronted with was, is the capacity to investigate corruption in the police? We have re-established that capacity, apart from the capacity that we have in the DPCI environment. Some of the specialized units that are being re-established, they are being re-established within the detective services environment, while we have got those units that are established in the DPCI environment that requires, where they are required to be able to focus on the cases at the level of the DPCI. So, Honorable Chair, the migration is not going to encroach, for example, on the budget which has been approved by Parliament for the DPCI environment. We are not touching anything there. We are simply taking the capacity which was investigating cases that are not falling within the ambit of the DPCI scope. I hope I've clarified this one, Chair. Now, the other question that earlier Honorable Mbele asked was that, are the figures of the DPCI in the total establishment of the department? Yes, they are in that total establishment, but they are also within the Program 3 fixed establishment. In Program 3 fixed establishment, they will then be demarcated specifically for the DPCI environment. So, the bigger picture, if we say we are 198,000 or whatever number, that number will provide for will include the DPCI. When we say the number of detectives, like the figure that we have given, it's 25,000. What is it? I think I've given a number of 25,000 earlier. That number will not include the DPCI. So you will still have to add the DPCI number, which is separate from the general investigations numbers.
Billy? Thanks, Chair, and thank you to the Acting Commissioner. I've got a little more clarity. I'm probably just being a bit slow, so I'll take that as it's given. But then, Chair, then I foresee a potential challenge in the short to medium term, given that the budget baselines are going to be fixed. In the austerity environment we're going to be facing, and given that the national head of the DPCI by statute has independent power to fix his own establishment for the DPCI, but it's located within the SAP's fixed establishment, which is determined by the National Commissioner. What happens when there are competing fixed establishment needs, where you need to shrink, he needs to expand, who cuts into who?
Honorable Chair, we will not get there. It's not even a problem, and I don't think it's going to be a problem, because there is an understanding on what the independence of the DPCI entails. That if there were to be any issue, these issues are to be resolved in consultation. The Act is very clear. The head of the DPCI makes a determination, and that determination is to be in consultation. Decisions there will always be in consultation. In some instances, it's in consultation with the minister, in consultation with the national commissioner. For example, at this stage, and that's why I was able to respond to the issue of the Auditor General, because it falls within one of those areas in as far as the strategic plan is concerned. It is not in respect of the investigations. When it comes to investigations, that is purely the national head's mandate. But there is only one accounting officer at this stage for the department, and that's why we will be accounting on some of the of the matters there. So I don't think, Honourable Chair, we have got the reason to be concerned, and I think Honourable Mbele can be at ease because ours is to make sure that there is capacity there to be able to investigate those cases that are at that level. And the national head makes the determination, and it is a determination that is made within the prescripts, and then capacity is being given.
Chair, just a small parting comment. At this moment in time, I'm at ease. If nothing more than as a reflection of, I think both my and the committee's confidence in the acting commissioner. I just have a concern that, structurally speaking, there may come a point in time where the individuals occupying these two positions are going to be at loggerheads, and then focus on dance. Thank you, Chair.
I appreciate the Honourable Mbele's comment on this. Be assured, one of the things that we do very regularly is to take that act and just put it before us and ask, what does it mean, and how do we ensure that there is full compliance? These issues that I'm raising are issues that we have deliberated on and say, let's do the ticks. Which part of this act is not yet implemented? Because ours is to fully implement. And my suspicion, Chair, is that it doesn't matter whether it is me acting or someone else. That act cannot change because of personalities. They need to make sure that we translate it truly into practice and not create the confusion around what is going to happen. Because if we do that, we will be creating room for those that want to launch an attack on us to do so. So ours is to comply with the law, and we will do that fully, Honourable Chair.
Other responses?
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Honourable Members, Janama Tagata, you'll take number one.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Honourable Members, I'm going to respond to the question by the Chair on the finding by the auditors around the performance indicator on the value of amount involved in procurement. With the auditing that was done, we, as DPCI, struggled to get the supporting evidence that was required, because this performance indicator is located within NPA. AFU, to be specific, is the custodian of this indicator. But having struggled to get the supporting evidence, eventually it was provided. But we've put a system in place that we would get quarterly reports from AFU, from the NPA, that and the supporting evidence that will be with us, so that we can provide it as and when the Auditor General is doing the audits in the DPCI. Thanks.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, coming to the issues of the filling of the vacancies. When we came here on the 23rd of August, we spoke of the outstanding 308 vacancies. But now, 154 have been filled, and we're left with 226. And I promise this Honourable Committee that by the end of the financial year, we'll be finished. And with the cooperation I'm getting from the side of the human resource of the South African Police Service, we're moving. We're left now with 226, and definitely when we come at the end of the financial year, we'll be saying, we've done it.
coming to Honorable Mbele's question, do we stand, where do we stand currently on the filling of vacancies for, I mean, a post? The same answer, Honorable. Thanks. The same answer. Coming now in terms of Section 17J, the Operational Committee. We are meeting as stipulated in terms of the Act. And then now the issues that are discussed, they're about the cases that are referred there. But I want just to say, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, we don't wait. If there are cases that came with it, that issue of four times is not talking. If there are cases, we don't just pass cases, we are moving. Coming now to Honorable Ramahlakane, target review on ACTT. What will be the process, the review, to review the target? What is your comment? What is my comment? That one is very simple. As ACTT were composed of outside stakeholders like NPA and etc. So this target, if we're going to review the target in terms of the ACTT, there must be agreement within the committee. Is what we're going to do.
Thank you. Is that all the responses? Yeah. Members, any other questions? Maybe I just want to indicate that in terms of the annual report, I raised it yesterday. I think going forward, in terms of the annual report, there must be a separate section for DPCI in terms of the Act, in terms of the program and the budget, more specifically indicated as in the present circumstances, that so it can comply with the SAPS Amendment Act. Then furthermore, also in terms of, and we'll also include that as a recommendation, the executive authority should also comply in terms of the reporting obligations in terms of the Act, but we'll also specify that, although it's not your responsibility, but we just want to note that all obligations in terms of the amended SAPS Act is implemented in terms of the DPCI. That's quite important from the committee side. Right, thank you very much. Can we, I don't know whether, did we do forensics? Not. So let's do forensics, and then, and then we'll have to go to CI. So, yeah, can we continue?
Honourable Chair, members, thank you. The moving into the forensics environment, the first indicator in that part of Program 3 that relates to the forensics is the percentage of original previous conviction reports generated. The target was set at 94% of original previous conviction reports to be generated within 15 calendar days. The actual achievement was 97.02%. It refers to the 1.1 million records that were generated for previous conviction reports, and that the actual achievement is 3.02% better than the set target. There was more emphasis placed on the generating of these previous conviction reports, and clear reaction times were also stipulated for the processing of the reports, and then less downtime was recorded on the IFAS system, and a strategy on daily monitoring of cases was implemented by the relevant division. The next indicator is the percentage of routine case exhibits or entries finalized within 18 to 28 working days. The target was set at 93% of the routine case exhibits to be processed within 28 working days. The actual achievement was 70.61%. The numbers are quoted there. It's 146,000 out of 207,000 that were finalized within 28 working days. That is unfortunately 22.39 percentage points below the set target. The FSL experienced downtime of critical systems as listed there during the latter part of the financial year, which had a negative impact on the performance and the realization of the set target. Environmental control challenges in the laboratory had a negative impact on instrumentation performance, thereby reducing the finalization rate of ballistics and drug-related case exhibits. The corrective measures implemented with a specific reference to the downtime, resolving technical problems with regard to the STR lab FSL admin system, optimal utilization of existing reference index and crime investigation technology, piloting the implementation of rapid drug analysis of, I'm not going to say that word, utilizing Raymond instruments, environmental control challenges in the laboratory KZN, the air conditioning system was fitted in the affected laboratory. The percentage of non-routine case exhibits finalized within 75 working days, the target was set at 76% of the non-routine case exhibits to be processed within 75 working days. Actual performance was 64.94%. That amounts to 4,010 from a total of 6,175 who were finalized within 75 working days. The actual performance is unfortunately 11.06 percentage points below the set target. The influencing the non-achievement of the target was the over-influx of casework in the FSL. The FSL received a large quantity of precious metal and pharmaceutical-related case exhibits, which takes longer than to finalize, thus impacting on the overall finalization rate of the division. The percentage of DNA intelligence case exhibits finalized within 63 working days, a target was set at 65% of DNA intelligence case exhibits to be processed within 63 working days. Actual performance was 59.59%, that's 54,941 out of 92,195. Were finalized within the 63 working days. That is unfortunately 5.41 percentage points below the target. That's attributed to the high volumes of cases which were received due to the implementation of the DNA Act, and also a delay in the awarded contract impacting negatively on the finalization rate of cases. The corrective measures implemented is the completion of a reference index RA samples to be done automatically on the FSL administration system. The next indicator is the percentage reduction in case exhibits exceeding the prescribed time frame of 28 working days. That refers to the backlog. The target was set that the backlog should not exceed 10% of case exhibits on hand. The actual performance was 5.19% backlog. That is 18,488 out of 356,426 case exhibits. And the actual performance is then 4.81 percentage points better than the set target. Commence. The environment had a dual focus on both the normal routine and non-routine cases as well as the backlog, and the realization of the consumable contract made it easy for the environment to achieve, particularly in the biology environment. The next indicator is the percentage of ballistics intelligence case exhibits or IBIS intelligence case exhibits finalized within 28 working days. The target was set at 95% of the ballistics or IBIS intelligence case exhibits to be finalized within 28 working days. The actual performance was 96.85%, that is 17,136 out of a potential 17,693 that were dealt with within 28 working days. So the actual achievement is 1.85 percentage points better than the set target. The intelligence ballistic identification system was recently upgraded. This ensured that the backlogs in viewing were eradicated by having more processing of results done quicker by the EBA system. Honorable Chair, that concludes the forensics or the FSL part.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, let's just deal with that few slides before we move on to the program for the introduction of the delegation. Questions, members, on these slides? Honorable Molobatsi.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I want to ask that favorite question of mine, General Fasai. Your quality controller, have you appointed a permanent one
or is General Sales still there and TMS also, or what? My next one, I see your social workers role has expanded to statement taking of children. How were they trained to do this? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mamula, you covered. Honorable Bele.
Thanks, Chair. I did have a question that sprang up while it was being presented. I'm just trying to remind myself which slide it was. Oh, I think it was, and I can probably just find this in the annual report, but it was to ask what the basic difference is between routine and non-routine exhibits, because they have quite different time frames. One is 28 days to complete, the other 75, so just what that difference is and the reason for that. And then, Chair, am I correct in understanding that the Criminal Records Center falls under the same sub-program? Am I wrong? This is correct. Sorry, I couldn't find the slide that gives the sub-programs. Because the CRC is another challenging, call it sub-environment. I assume that the indicator about previous conviction records, conviction reports relate to this, where a number of times I've heard about complaints about members of the public needing to get their police clearance certificates, and I'm not sure if the bottleneck is at station level or actually at the CRC, because I understand they all have to be sent centrally to Pretoria. Just to get a sense of what are the plans are to address that and to speed it up. And although I know that you're obviously dealing with sensitive information, is there any prospects on the purely administrative side to look at, I don't know if the solution might be outsourcing or whatever the case might be, but is there a way just to make those cogs grind a bit more smoothly and a bit more quicker, so we can just address that issue? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable Ramatlakhani.
Well, the other question I think was already answered before, but let me ask the question about the whole thing about the DA intelligence, the DNA intelligence cases that were supposed to be dealt within 63 days. What is the challenge around that you're not achieving that particular target?
Thank you very much. Groenewald.
Thank you, Chair. It's the same question, but on that same slide, it says that the delay in the awarded contract impacted negatively. Can my mind just be refreshed? What contract and why? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the responses.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. For a moment, I'll pretend I'm not the Divisional Commissioner of Forensic Services. From time to time, I'll go back to my colleagues. But the first question of the quality manager, honorable members will recall General Shezi is now permanently appointed as the Divisional Commissioner of Technology Management Services. Following her appointment, we had appointed Major General Tili Manamela as the head of quality management, replacing General Shezi. But she is not on her own. There are other quality managers that have been appointed, both at divisional as well as within the various laboratories. And we also have went further to appoint the quality managers in the criminal record and crime scene management environment. So we are progressing well in that regard. On the one of social workers, I suspect Honorable Mulebatsi is referring to the forensic social workers. Those are deployed within the detective services environment, and it is precisely their role to assist, for example, in processing investigations around children and so on. And we also continue to capacitate the environment accordingly.
Mulbachi?
I understand what you're saying, General Pazani, but my question was on how were they trained to take statements, because they are just social workers. Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. It is more about the internal training that they receive, but there is also training that some of them, I think initially the majority of them were trained, I just can't remember, but there was one of the universities in the Eastern Cape, you know, to build capacity for them to be able to do that work. So there is specialized training that they receive internally to be able to, because they also in some instances assist in courts in taking cases to court, especially of those people that falls within their scope of work. Honorable Mbele, let me deal with one or two, and I'll ask my colleagues to talk to them. We actually are doing very well as the police, as the criminal record and crime scene management in the processing of police clearance certificate. If you know there, we now are able to process, what is the rate now? 90. Here we say the previous original previous conviction reports generated within 15 calendar days. It is in the same environment where the police clearance certificates are being processed, and I think we are now in the main under 10 days where we are able to issue. The problem with the police clearance certificate, one is you find someone having to travel abroad and on a short notice wanting to apply. That's the very first problem. So if we were to be given time, people do not apply when they are under pressure, it will be a little bit easier. Secondly, at some point we had a problem. Remember when there was the post office strike? Because many of the applicants, or when they apply, they also have to give us a self-addressed envelope. So once the police clearance is available, it is then posted back to the individual. But for a period, there was an issue because they were not receiving back their police clearance certificates. But we have, for example, an SMS system. In other words, once you tender your application and it has been registered, you will get a notification. Once it is completed, you will also get a notification. We are also confronted with attempts by people, because you pay when you apply for a police clearance. I think you pay 96 and 97 rands. Now, people will claim that they did not receive one, whereas they are looking for more copies out of that 97, especially if a person is applying for a job. There they are looking, so they are trying to have more copies out of one. But I think it's an area where we are doing exceptionally very well. Maybe let me ask General Mangali just to give the figures there on the police clearance certificate.
General, we are currently, thanks Chair, and thanks Honourable Members, we are currently running at 98% in 15 days in relation to the police clearance certificate. We, in the last financial year, we processed around about 79,000 police clearance certificate. What inflated the complaints were the issues relating to Zimbabwe dispensation as well as Lesotho dispensation. People actually misunderstood the process that Home Affairs at the point dictated, and then they took the wrong route in coming to us, and that inflated also the problem, adding up to what the General was saying.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. So the issue of outsourcing when it comes to police clearance, it's a no-no, because even especially the other countries, the embassies, they will want a police clearance certificate. It must have the authentic stamp of the police. So it's unfortunately not one that can be outsourced. But as we are responding, 98% tells that we are doing very well. There is no reason why we should outsource such or be concerned. The routine, non-routine, maybe we can talk to it.
Thanks, General. I think maybe in simple terms, routine imply to the normal cases where there is no complexity involved in the analyzing of the case. Whereas in terms of the non-routine, it's normally the large cases where they say, for instance, it's a ballistic case, there's over 100 cartridges that needs to be analyzed. So it become non-routine in the sense that you will have to analyze each cartridge to ensure that you come to a conclusion. So a non-routine is more complex kind of a case. If, for instance, it's a precious metal and there is a lot of pieces that needs to be analyzed, it means we must do it per exhibit, because now if you just take a sample, you would be faulted to think that it is a routine case. So you need to do it, and hence the timelines will not then be the same. They will be some will be quicker, some will be then take a longer period, because it also include the processes in relation to quality management that needs to unfold after the analysis in reviewing the case and ensuring that we are accurate in terms of what we are doing.
Maybe, Honorable Chair, just to substantiate, if you take, for example, the case, the Oscar Pistorius case, it was not a routine case because of the number of exhibits, exhibits and samples generated from that particular case. If I'm not wrong, we had close to 99 exhibits that were to be processed. So already when you are sitting with the 99, the chances of you finalizing it within the number of days, it becomes a little bit problematic. So it is cases like those where we need a little bit a longer period to have them finalized. If it is, let's say, a huge drug bust, for example, a laboratory where you find a wide range of drugs. It is a complex case that requires, a longer period to have it processed. That is why you will find a very clear distinction on the routine as well as the non-routine case exhibits. Can I ask Honorable Chair Brigadier Petra to just briefly deal with the DNA intelligence?
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members and general, the DNA intelligence cases, the challenge that we had in 2015-16 is the finalization of the RI systems, that contract. That has been finalized now. All four of the systems is up and running, and currently we show a 3 times higher throughput than what we showed last year. For the previous quarter, we finalized 99,000 DNA intelligence cases with a success rate of 84%. So that was the challenge we had, but it was successfully finalized, and we're showing much more improvement in that environment.
I think the question by Honorable Groenewald, what contract? I know we talk RI now. We understand that language. What is RI and what is this contract supposed to do?
Thank you, General. There was a bit advertised specifically to analyze the reference index systems, or as I hear it is common known here as the buccal samples. And that contract was a bit slow in the finalization due to the validations that needed to be done, and also the committee will remember the refurbishment that was done in the Plattekloof laboratory to specifically house 3 of those systems, and that is the contract we're referring to. Attorney General, did I address the question?
Honorable Chair, thanks. There was, I think it's all the questions that have been taken care of. Thanks, Chair.
Maybe just a question from my side. The factors leading to the downtime of critical systems in the FLS environment, including FSL administration and the short tandem repeat laboratories during the latter part of the financial year, is that issue being addressed? What is the status of that? Thank you.
Honorable Chair, it is being addressed. The laboratory, as we all know, is a very sensitive environment. For example, it's being impacted by heat, temperature. It's being impacted by electricity. If, for example, there's a problem there, we have got the problems. We had serious problems in KwaZulu-Natal. Because of the proximity of the lab to the sea, the area is very humid, and it impacts a lot. If, for example, your air conditioning system is not operational, it impacts big time, even on the functioning of the equipment. But all these are matters that has been addressed. We are now looking at an option of relocating that laboratory in Amanzimtoti to a place further on from where it is located, to give ourselves a chance not to have the same problems. We also, it is located in an area because it's a rented space. It is located in an area which easily gets flooded, which is a problem in itself. But also downtime will be from the system side, because we are dependent a lot on CETA, like our the Star Lab and so on. If there are challenges with the service providers to get them activated to be on site much quicker, it impacts, because you lose a day, it's a problem in the lab. All those exhibits that are coming in. Amongst others, Honorable Chair, we know that the Honorable Members are very much aware of the DNA Act. And I think there was always a suspicion from the committee side that at some point there is going to be a huge influx of samples. And that has been the case. That's why they could not be processed manually. So as they came in large numbers, the system had to be up and running. And only now that the contracts are in place, it's making it possible for us to do the processing thereof. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Honorable Bachi.
Thank you, Chairperson. You made mention of first responders. Where are they placed? The local police stations, where are they placed? Thank you.
Honorable Chair, the first responders are those members at station level, these ones who are driving the vans around, attending to a complaint, because if there is a complaint, they are the first one to come in, or even in the other units. So they are all over the country. That's why we will systematically be covering them, having now created that capacity within the investigation environment.
Thank you, General. Honorable
Chair, just a small question in terms of the awarded contract. What is the duration of that we referring to? Is it infinity? Is it for life? It's a specified contract?
Chair, I'm still 2 years. The RI, the consumable contract, it's 2 years. On average, our contracts are 2-3 years, which requires from us every third year to activate the process to secure a contract. If it is equipment, you would have secured a contract to be able to deliver the equipment, and there will also be some maintenance that may stretch a little bit longer than the 2 year or 3 year period. But ordinarily, the laboratory equipment, I think the lifespan is on average 5 years. So after the 5 years, then you restart the process to check from a research perspective what is available on the market, what is better to enable us to do speedy processing of these exhibits. Thanks, Chair.
Yes, thanks, Chair. One of the issues that was raised by SAPU is forensic is not what it used to be since you have multiple roles. What is your response? Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Chair, they must at least give me credit that I have established the capacity in that environment. That's why I'm not day-to-day managing them. Here they are managing that division very well. They actually struggle to find me with my other responsibilities. No. I think if they were to share notes, I would have advised them to delete that one. We are doing well in that space. Thanks, Chair. Honorable Chair, honorable members, thank you very much. For the program, the crime intelligence, we are joined by the acting divisional commissioner, Major General Makhele. She is also with the provincial head of the crime intelligence environment in the Western Cape, Major General Tio. And Chair, I'll request that General Ravi proceed with the presentation.
Thank you very much.
Honorable Chair, thank you. Moving to Program 4 that deals with crime intelligence in the South African Police Service. In terms of crime intelligence, we monitor a total of 10 targets and or 10 key performance indicators, and we've achieved our targets in terms of all 10 of those indicators. You will also note that if we look at the medium-term period from 2013-14, the achievement or the success rate has always been 100% for the last 3 years.
The first indicator that we monitor is the number of inquiries that has been that have been investigated by crime intelligence, and the planned target was 13,350. The actual performance is amounted to 47,349. So the actual number is 33,999 more than the target that was set. Now, the reason for achieving the target is that the policies and working procedures of the division were approved in March 2015, which clarified the categorization of inquiries, ad hoc operations, and network operations, and there was also an optimized monitoring of crime intelligence working procedures that resulted in improved record keeping and overall improvement in performance. The highlights, just to highlight one issue, the intelligence gathered during the inquiry phase contributed to more than 6,300 arrests and seizures exceeding 800 million, which included drugs, stolen goods, contraband, and illegal firearms and ammunition. The next indicator is the number of ad hoc operations conducted. The target was set at 20,023. The actual performance, 39,066. That is 19,043 more than the set target. And the same reasons are quoted for the achievement or the achievement of the target when it comes to this specific indicator. Some highlights, the intelligence gathered through these ad hoc or tactical operations contributed to more than 5,100 arrests, and seizures exceeding 700 million, which also included drugs, stolen goods, contraband, and illegal firearms and ammunition. The number of network operations conducted by crime intelligence, the planned target was set at 759. The actual performance is 859, so that's 100 more than the target. The same reasons quoted for the achievement of the target is the first indicator. Highlights, intelligence gathered through this network or these network operations contributed to more than 2,900 arrests and seizures that exceeded 400 million, and it included the same categories of drugs, stolen goods, contraband, firearms and ammunition. Percentage of physical security threat assessments finalized as per the request. The planned target was to deal with 100% of the requests that's been received. The actual performance was 100%, 380 requests were received and finalized, so with regard to that, the target was achieved. The next indicator is the percentage of cross-border operations conducted in relation to requests received. The target was also set at 100% of the requests that we received through the crime intelligence channels. The actual performance was 100%, 9 out of the 9 requests that were received, and the target was achieved. A significant highlight include the Interpol operation between South Africa and 10 other African countries targeting ivory trafficking. This operation resulted in 376 arrests, seizure of 4.5 tons of elephant ivory and rhino horn, and the investigation of 25 criminal groups involved in illicit trade. Percentage arrest of identified transnational crime suspects facilitated. The target was also set at 100% of the request received, or the actual performance was 100%, 340 received, and 340 has been facilitated. So in that regard, the target was also achieved. Some of the highlights include the following: a British national sought by the UK for 12 charges of indecent assault and sexual offences involving minors. The suspect was arrested in Gauteng after hiding in South Africa for several years. Canadian fugitive was arrested by Interpol extradition task team in Gauteng. The fugitive was on the run for more than 2 years for murder and possession of illegal firearms. And British fraudster wanted in UK for committing fraud to the amount of £3.5 million was also arrested in Cape Town after he's been in South Africa for a period of 5 years. Percentage of Interpol cases case files closed. The target was set at 70%, and we actually achieved 74.5%. That amounts to the amount involved is 1,400 case files, relative to 1,000, and of which 1,043 were closed. That is, the actual performance is then 4.5% better, percentage points better than the set target. The division allocated additional resources to the distribution desks, which resulted in improved performance. The proper implementation of standard operating procedures optimized the flow of work within the division, thereby ensuring clear timeframes and regular inspections, and that had a positive impact on the time it took to finalize cases, and there was also regular inspections
improved command and control, thereby improving the quality of work overall. Highlights, there's the extradition of a fugitive wanted for various crimes committed in the USA, and the fugitive was subject to an investigation involving the intrusion of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, headquarters' computer system in Washington, USA. The number of intelligence products generated, a total target was set at 158,283. The actual achievement was 386,732. Then there's a breakdown of profiles, 192,000. Intelligence analysis report, 131,000. Communication analysis report, 10,000. Communication interception analysis report, 12,000. And cluster crime threat analysis report, 39,000. So we exceeded the target with 228,000 products. And the capacity of the analysis environment within crime intelligence was increased through the promotion process, which enabled increased production, thereby allowing for set targets to be exceeded. The increase in the number of major events during the period also contributed to the division exceeding its set target, as more individuals and service providers had to be profiled. The products generated by this capacity indirectly contributed to the arrest of 14,406 suspects and confiscation of goods to the value of more than $2 billion. The number of strategic intelligence reports provided to SAP's management, the target was set at 4 reports, the actual performance was 7, that is 3 more than the target, and that was due to the fact that there was an increased need for strategic intelligence reports due to the increased incidence of protest actions at higher institutions of learning throughout the country. Strategic intelligence reports generated to address national NICOC priorities. The planned target was set at 6 strategic intelligence reports. Actual performance 10, that's 4 more than the set target. And there was also an increased need for strategic intelligence reports due to the increased incidence of protest action at institutions of higher learning throughout the country. Chair, Honorable Chair, that concludes overview of Program 4, Crime Intelligence. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we will now go to questions with regard to crime intelligence. Thank you very much. Honourable Mulabatsi.
Yes, thanks. My first question is on the vetting. Are all members in this environment vetted? My second question, tell us about the usage of informers. Thanks.
Very much, Honourable Mamula.
Thank you, Chairperson. Is Molebasa's question of vetting in another fashion, because there's a performance indicator for vetting set of personnel in 2016-17. How far have you gone with this vetting for the financial year, as it is almost ending? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Honourable Bailey.
Thank you, Chair. I mean, mine is probably just a more general point, because the performance indicators look good at the surface level, but the challenge I'm having, Chair, is reconciling the performance report information, which indicates that all targets were met and exceeded, and the financial reports says that all the funds were spent. But when you look at the crime picture in reality, with the increase in some categories of organized crime, such as car hijacking, and there were, I think, both business and home burglaries, if not just the one, and the fact that a contributor to the increase in the murder rate was murders that happened in the execution of some other kind of property crime behind which tends to lie some sort of syndicates. I'm having difficulty reconciling those two and just trying to understand if, to me at the very least, it suggests that if the Crime Intelligence Division is spending all their money and meeting all their targets, but we still have a problem having a grip on organized crime and syndicate crime, then they just haven't got enough money because they aren't able to cover all the ground that they potentially could. And so I guess my general question is, what would the acting commissioner make of that, of reconciling those two realities? Between what the information on paper says, both financially and performance-wise, and the reality that we saw both in the crime stats as well as the ongoing trends, because the only time we ever seem to have a positive impact from crime intelligence is when they operate in a task team context. So when you have the anti-truck hijacking task team, crime intelligence cracks down and we get the job done, and so on and so forth. And I imagine the same as well in the rhino poaching environment. But in terms of just the general having a grip on, you know, those four or five squallies who are breaking into all the houses, like, where are we seeing that kind of thing? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Rahmat Lakhan.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just a quick one. I just want to check the target of 60% that for 2016-17, the old issue about the personnel vetting was set at 60%. I just want to find out why. Why 60%? Were you unsure whether the other 40% would be met, and therefore you will park it for the next financial year? Secondly, the one question that worries me all the time, Chair, is this issue about the capacity and the footprint of intelligence operation. If we talk about intelligence-led crime-fighting strategy, we're talking about all these other things. But I always have an issue about the capacity and the footprint and the requisite skills for that. Now, I just want to understand, Commissioner, in terms of this, what would you say in terms of the capacity, if you were to look at your higher category of provinces in terms of the contribution on crime, particularly the crime that is difficult one, what would you say the capacity issue is being addressed in terms of that? I mean, a lot of you have spoken about Western Cape, number one murder capital, number one station in the country, persisting, ongoing. The last time I received a request from the community of Nyanga, led by the CPF, that they want now the deputy president to come to Nyanga and to come and engage with the community there about why is it that Nyanga's problems, including the capacity of the enforcement agencies, is unable to deal with the problem of Nyanga. Now, I don't know, you may want to comment. If you were to look at the station like clusters where there is a high crime in terms of that, what would you say is the capacity of the area that is given to either a cluster or the province? I don't know what Western Cape capacity is, but I worry when I look at the capacity in terms of what happens in Nyanga. What is it Do we have a requisite or number or skills or capacity, and what is the program going forward? The last time we spoke about this thing, we were raising the concern about the capabilities of the intelligence insofar as detection upfront before the incident. And I think we engaged with the, Commissioner Cruiser, and we asked the same question. The response was that there is capacity, but the problem sometimes is interpretation of information. What to do with the information, the raw data, for example, if I were to use that language. So I want to ask the same question. I mean, there's much has been said about the protest now, the fees must fall. That the other time we were speaking about other incidents, we were speaking about the crime related to school, the banning of school, torching of schools. And in that context, that's when there was a response that there is a capacity, but the capacity is, the lack of it is in the interpretation of that kind of information. So I just want to find out from you, what is your take on that? And speak specifically about the high category of areas, like I'm saying, in the Western Cape. What is it that is can be done in terms of detection led by the intelligence? Are you happy with your footprint in the area like Nyanga, for an example, in terms of collection? What is that capacity? Now, I know that the question has been said, tell us about the informants. I'm asking it in a broader sense, that it's well and good to talk about it, but whether the capacity and skills to be able to do that interpretation is there. Now, and going forward, what is the plan to further capacitate the visions in terms of this area? Because unless we get this area right, unless we capacitate this area, we are going to react. It's going to be a reaction. And I mean, in policing, you can't rely on reaction because it's too late. You should be able to get that information and act on it beforehand. And by asking this question, I don't suggest that there isn't any. And I don't suggest that you have not been able to be proactive. But the incident, high-profile incident, also shows that sometimes we were found flat-footed around this particular area. And for my question, therefore, is that what is it that we need to do to address that particular question? Otherwise, we're going to be able to all the time respond to it. And the police can't go and look an incident after the fait accompli and then be in the scene when the thing is done. So that's really the question that I want to just get to understand. So there are three questions really around this particular thing. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Groenewald, and then I'll come back to Honourable Mamula. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, yes. I also want to know about the capacity. And the other field I'm a bit worried, Chairperson, is the field of crime intelligence versus, say, the state security agency. Let's take, for instance, the students' protest at the higher education institutions. Can I get more information of, if we say we are doing intelligence gathering there, can we then get an update of what is going on? How long are we still going to have this specific situation? So that we can understand. And I'm tempted to ask a question, but I spoke to the commissioner yesterday, and Commissioner, okay, I respect you, I won't ask that question, but let me say this. Let's just get an update on the protest, because it's got huge impact on South Africa at this moment, and the students who wants to complete their academic years. Then my second question, Chairperson, is on the gangs, specifically on the Western Cape. And we had numerous presentations on that. And in every presentation, it is admitted that, yes, crime intelligence is a bit of a problem. We don't have the capacity for that. Is it still like that? Or has it been updated? If so, how was it updated? And what is the situation as far as that is concerned? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mula.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for your presentation. Can you please give details on the nature of the 9 cross-border operations that were conducted in 2015 and 16, and also the outcomes of these operations? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson. The last one, can just the NETCOM to just indicate the manner in which the monitoring of crime intelligence working procedures are optimized. Thank you.
Chairperson, I just got a message from my constituency that in turn it's bad as we speak. So my question is, were you alerted before? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, members. Just a couple from my side. I just want to get a sense. During our visit in the Eastern Cape, we visited Operation Lockdown's headquarters at Mountain Road, and I think the model that they have there is a very good model, dealing with especially gangster violence and the involvement of crime intelligence, with the involvement of crime intelligence. And I think also in the reports of DPCI, they've mentioned the important role of cooperation. So I just wanted to know also in terms of your threat analysis, some of the colleagues referred to it earlier, to anticipate what's coming. For example, also in the student environment, we had it last year. And I mean, in terms of the planning, do we anticipate that in our threat analysis, in terms of our deployment, recruitment, all those issues? I just want to get a sense of that. If we look at the annual report, there is a substantial decline in network operations. Now, on the same hand, Key crimes have increased, murder and robberies up. So I just want to get a sense the reason for the decline in network operations and also the decline in station and cluster CTAs. What is the rationale for that? Right, that is the first round. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. The vetting, now, as the vetting was being asked, I'm going through the presentation trying to locate it. I find nothing about vetting, I realize it is a target which we have in the current financial year as planned. Now, the reason why we will have a 60% target, that target is informed by the capacity available to process the application. So we will, from one year to the other, informed by the baseline, increase the target. We remain committed to ensure that everyone in the environment, including those prioritized environments, gets processed through the vetting process so that there is full compliance. The question, Honorable Mulewati, on the usage of informers, and I'm immediately going to tie it together with the question raised by Honorable Ramatlakane, is there is no crime intelligence environment which will succeed without the informers, without the deployment of agents, because that's where you source information from those that are involved in the commission of crime and so on. So the drive to recruit the informers is on an ongoing basis. In actual fact, I had a discussion with the acting divisional commissioner to say we need to review the number of the target in respect to the individual members so that we don't simply say to a person, you are supposed to have at least 5 informers. You can't, with the time, crime intelligence is their day-to-day business. So you can't rely only on 3, 4, 5 informers. You need a wider network, because what you must give ourselves chance for is the verification of what is coming through, so that you do not react off the cuff on information which is being processed to you. So to Honorable Mulebati, yes, informers are being utilized, and we continue to be managing that space. While I jump over to some issues that Honorable Ramatlakane indicated, the capacity of crime intelligence, now I'll give just the overall capacity, 7,023, if you include the 934 encounter, it brings you to 7,957 people. That is our capacity. Now, the question you will ask is this capacity enough? Is it adequate? If you were to do more, you definitely need more in this regard. I like what Honorable Ramatlakane continuously referring to ground coverage, because you don't only need that ground coverage with informers, you also need with your crime intelligence operative. And within the constraints of the fixed establishment, we continue to grow our capacity. At this stage, our crime intelligence structure stretches to the cluster level. You do have here and there what you'll find closer to a station, but the closest you get is at cluster. You have also agents deployed in this regard. And obviously, from an intelligence perspective, your force multiplier or your strongest resource will be informers that are supposed to be all over. What you refer to as, which is important, allowing us to detect upfront. In other words, let's not wait until crime is committed, and then we use intelligence to be able to react. Useful information or useful intelligence has been coming our way. If you look at the some of the operations, particularly around robberies, around heist and so on, where those that were going to commit a crime are intercepted, is as a result of intelligence that would have been made available, which would have allowed the planning, and that planning inform the deployment, and a number of such successful operations are done. If you take, for example, what is happening in the borders, you hear so many Home Affairs, so many police people that would have been arrested for the crimes committed there. Intelligence would have done work, work would have informed what we normally refer to as takedown operations. This includes even many of the laboratories or drug busts. Those are informed by the work of intelligence. Investigation capabilities normally comes in at a point where arrests are being made, but it is in the nature of intelligence work that we don't blow our horn in that regard to say intelligence, this normally your investigation or those that are doing takedown, they will communicate as if they were on their own there, whereas that information was generated by the intelligence structures. Honorable Mbele raised an issue about the reconciliation. I understood you referring to what we say we have achieved and what is happening in practice. Yes, we may ask that question, but we are certain that the product generated out of this performance, which has been recorded here, went a long way in assisting, in some instances, operations aimed at preventing the commission of crime, because that is what informs what we refer to as targeted policing. You can't just decide you are going to do operations in Cleveland or Austell just because there are people occupying that space. You do it informed by the availability, for example, of firearms in that particular space. So intelligence will have said to us, there, this and that is happening, and we act accordingly. We had an incident now, stock theft related, the border of Lesotho and the Eastern Cape, where the Lesotho police were very much concerned with the stock theft, alleging it is by South Africans. I think they were flighting something like 650 cattle. It was intelligence that was proactive in providing the information that resulted in the arrest of a Lesotho national who was this side that actually brought the cattle from Lesotho. Now the impression created will be South African people. They were found even with firearms coming from across the border. So there is definitely a relationship between that which we are reporting to and what is found on the ground. Of course, we will want to do more. When we communicated the crime statistics, we made visible that an area where we did not do that well was around contact crimes, and that is where your hijackings and so on are. The question is, where are all those vehicles that are being hijacked going to? Where is the market, and why are we not able to close that particular market? This is work that will continue to be done to enhance our intelligence capability, but most importantly, enable police operations. Honorable Mabija, the issue of vetting, I thought I've dealt with it. The issue relating to working procedures. Remember, in that environment, you have got two accounts. You have got the open account and the secret services account. In the open account, every rule, every policy that applies to any other division equally applies in the environment. It is only with regard to the secret account that there is a different regime that applies in that particular space. At an operational level, they are not supposed to be away from, you know, the provincial commissioner or the station commander or the cluster commander, because they are to support the provincial cluster and station commissioner in the execution of their work. They are to provide intelligence to enable that work. They do form part and parcel of the structures. Like if we are to constitute the PCCF, the Provincial Crime Combating Forum, the intelligence will be there for the purposes of sharing the information or intelligence at their disposal. The same applies to the cluster crime combating forum and the station crime combating forum, and the divisional commissioner of crime intelligence is also sitting at the national crime combating forum, but also within the national management forum, where there is interaction and exchange of information to enable policing. Honorable Groenewald, intelligence versus state security. Ours, as the police, will always be to focus on crime intelligence. Any intelligence or information related to crimes that are being committed, and not that we have to wait for something to happen. It is a requirement, and we continue to be pushing the crime intelligence environment that let us not be surprised, for example, by fees must fall. Now, in this situation, this has always been communicated. We knew from last year already that the fees must fall thing is not over, because if you say there was a 0% in the previous year, in this year, what is it? And we were always warned from an operational perspective. That is why we were able to deploy accordingly. Now, they will have said to us there is going to be that, but there are some of the actions which are spontaneous that you surely will not have expected intelligence to have laid their hands on, because the emotions do overtake people when they are on the ground. But with their deployment, you are able to follow through on some of those. That's why, in respect of the fees must fall, where are we now? We are in that stage where cases were investigated, and those cases are now being presented before the public prosecutions to take decisions and issue warrants of arrest, which will allow us to effect arrest where crimes have been committed. But those crimes that are being committed by individuals with us present, the arrests are to be effected immediately and be processed accordingly. We do, for example, now follow on what the trend is, who's moving where, for the purposes of inciting and so on. And that just happens, helps to strengthen the cases that we are busy looking at.
Sorry, Chair, on this specific point, as the General has said, it already started last year. The impression is created that some of the students have been arrested, but they were never prosecuted. In fact, nothing happened to them. Can we have more clarity on that? Because, Chairperson, if I was a student and I did something wrong and nothing happened to me, I can assure you I will go a further mile to create more havoc as far as that is concerned. Because if the students did not, if they were not prosecuted and follow-ups have been done, I mean, then nothing has been done towards them.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I unfortunately don't have that information which I had earlier in the week here, which I would have made visible the number of cases that we were opened, that were investigated, the number of arrests. I think from the 1st of February this year we did the press briefing on Thursday last week, it was 327 people that we have arrested. and some of those cases are still before the courts. Unfortunately, it's a process that we do not have control over. We so wish that once those arrests are made, the speedy processing of those cases, so that there are lessons learned out of this. Just, I think the University of the Free State in this week, I think they have arrested close to 62 students, and all over there are arrests that are being effected. Here, I was told overnight there was an incident that also resulted in some arrests. So, unfortunately, I don't have those figures in terms of where the cases are, but there is definitely work that we are doing as the police.
But just for clarity, do I understand that we have this 312 arrested people or students? So as far as the police is concerned, they completed their investigation. I can, for instance, say the dockets has been completed. It's trial-ready dockets of all the students. So the problem is lying with the NPA. But as far as the police, that we have the assurance that that all the dockets of all the arrested people, they are trial-ready, if I can use that term.
Honourable Chair, I can say that the dockets from February onwards were presented before the courts, and some people are still on trial in the courts. It is the latest ones that obviously maybe the investigation is still being done. Some of them, those investigations were concluded, and there is engagement with the prosecution to allow the warrant, the decision to be taken, which will then culminate into people being arrested. But that work is being done, Chair. The gangs, Honourable Chair, it is also an issue that is never going to go away from our priority list, because now you, in the past, when you were talking gangs, they were more related to drugs and so on. But there are so many types of gangs that, are mushrooming. Maybe it's because of the organized nature or that the crime have taken. But in this space, there is work that intelligence does in deploying, and which is enabling us to effect arrest, and I'm glad the honourable members were in the Eastern Cape with Project Operation Lockdown. Now, that's one of our success stories. 30 people were targets. All 30 of them have been arrested. Of course. Again, it's a situation of you have effected arrest, they go to court. These are people with monies. They manage to get the best lawyers, and they are given bails. But at least in that instance, the conviction rate is very much encouraging. Even the terms of sentences dished out is very, very encouraging. I'll ask General Makhele to talk on the nature of the cross-border operations, the nine ones referred to in there, and also the second one, the decline in... what did we say? Decline in network operations. I think let's deal with those issues.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members. Thank you, General. I will be very generic. I'm not going to go to details. One of the cases that was key was where one suspect was linked to 19 fraud cases that cost NASA to lose 500 million. And then the second one, the cross-border one, human trafficking, the drug trafficking, the wild life crimes, and then theft of motor vehicles. Thank you, Honorable Chair. And then the issue of the network operations. Network operation is one of our conventional means whereby we deal with the syndicate, and it's not only crime intelligence that is involved. We have other role players that are involved, and then the independency thereof of the product that we give depend on other people, and then we don't most of the time get feedback. So as to whether it was utilized effectively and efficiently, so it's a big question, but then it is incumbent upon us to ensure that we have the roadshows, we go and skill our clients as to the understanding of how to task crime intelligence, how to utilize their product, and to understand information collected. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
First of my question was the link. We saw an increase in contact crime, serious crime, robberies, murder. I just wanted to know the fact that the network operations has been declining. Is that having? Is there a link?
There is. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. There is a link. There is a link, Honourable Chair, of the network operation in impacting in the increase of crime. Like I've indicated, we will identify the people involved, investigate, but then the dependency thereof as to whether it will impact negatively or positively depend on the end user, the people that will be now carrying the dockets, taking them to court, because usually we don't get a feedback. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Is that all the responses?
It's all the responses, Chair.
Right. Honorable Members, let's just take a 5-minute coffee tea break, get you, and then we come back to the second round. 5 minutes? 5 minutes, tea and coffee is available and water. You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honourable members. Let us convene again that we can continue with our discussions. When we broke just before the afternoon tea, we're busy with crime intelligence, the last responses. Maybe from the member side, is there anything else at this stage that members want to raise in terms of this? Honourable Mbele, Honourable Ramatlakane.
Thank you, Chair. The one question is a follow-up from a point made by the Acting Commissioner, and then a new question. On the issue of vetting, which was first asked by Honourable Mulabati, and the Acting Commissioner indicated that they are committed to making the whole issue addressed and they're on the way. But I was just wondering, from a process integrity perspective, ideally, should the vetting of CI members not be done by an outside agency as a check and balance, in the same way that the vetting of, say, for example, SSA or IPIT should be done by somebody outside of those agencies? I understand that there's generally a capacity issue with bottlenecks, whichever way you sort of come at it from. But if we have CI members vetting other or new CI members, I'm just worried about the weakening of sort of checks and balances in terms of the integrity of that process. So what's the procedure or the guidelines around that? And then he also mentioned that crime intelligence operates down to cluster level, which we've heard before, that we don't have any crime intelligence operating strictly at station level, although the crime information officers, I think they're called, would be there. And page 220 of the annual report shows that there was quite a large decrease of cluster crime threat analysis reports. So and that's a decline of about, 17,000. About 17,000 count decline in cluster crime threat analysis reports. So if the cluster level is the operational interface, the coal face of crime intelligence in making an impact on the ground, and those outputs of the reports have declined by 17,000 in 1 year, that goes some way to explaining why we're having a challenge with tackling organized and syndicate crime. So just to ask the reason for that decline in those cluster level analysis reports, and what's going to be done to address that, because if I may be slightly facetious, Chair, if I'm a cluster commander who's hopefully daily reviewing and coordinating crime intelligence information, and there's a known syndicate head in my cluster that we're trying to nail, every morning I want to know how many teaspoons of sugar he had in his coffee. I want to know what color underwear he's wearing. That's how good I want the CI to be operating. So I mean, that's the level of efficacy I would like to see us being at. And seeing that drop in the cluster level analysis reports is not encouraging. So just some explanation around that, Chair, please.
No, Chair, thank you. Just a follow-up on my question around the Nyanga situation. I think the Commissioner's response is that it's located at the cluster level. Now, and I did ask what's the footprint, particularly around, I don't know which is accounting stations, whether it's Nyanga itself accounting station or some other stations. I did ask what is the footprint of that particular area. You may not have it, but earlier in the introduction you did mention that there is an acting or head of Western Cape in the meeting. So maybe he has that information at the fingertip about it. I'm asking it specifically because of the worry that that issue is an albatross. Nyanga is an albatross, which I don't know whether it receives sufficient attention for it to get out of where it is. Many years ago, Khayelitsha used to be number one problem, and that situation was arrested through a resource deployment. I'm just asking this Nyanga specifically. There's the second one, Chair, is that, you know, I went to George for something work-related, and I was surprised by being kind of being mobbed by some police officers there. Some of them were saying that their cover has been blown because they operate in the classified specific unit, and now this unit, they have been told to wear a uniform when they, all these years, they've been operating with the drugs, gangs, hijacking undercover without a uniform. One morning they were told to wear uniform, and because that unit, special unit, is no longer going to exist going forward. And the question they were asking me, and I said, look, I don't know what you're talking about, they said, but you are coming from Parliament. Now we've been working here 14 years in this undercover, now you're blowing our cover. You're telling us now with the people that we've been working with, we must now go and wear a uniform the next day. I continue to struggle to find that that kind of thinking. But earlier on, there was an answer that said, no, we don't expect people to wear uniform in this particular environment. You may not have a specific information now, but I think the Western Cape head may have that kind of information. What is happening? Because otherwise, you on one hand you're saying you're doing this, on one hand you are compromising what you are saying you are doing. Thank you, Chair.
Any other members? Honourable Grindelwald.
Thank you, Chair. My last question on the students. I didn't get a clear answer from the Commissioner or Acting Commissioner on whether the end is in sight. As far as the protests are concerned. My last question then, Chairperson, in crime intelligence, when it comes to telephone interception, do they do it on their own or do they do it through the State Security Agency? And if they do it on their own, which are they approaching specific judges or not? I see there's a general there's...
Is that the questions? Thank you very much, General.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Maybe the one I want to start with is that of Honorable Ramatakane on the cover blown. If those people are employed in the crime intelligence environment, ordinarily, it will not be a requirement for them to function in uniform. But if they were detectives or people operating without uniform, with their deployment being in the uniform environment, there will be nothing wrong to make them wear uniform because of our approach to advance police visibility. But because we don't have the details of that particular matter, Chair, I'm going to request General Tio. Unfortunately, the provincial commissioner is in here now. I'll ask them to check what who are we talking of and what is it that they are supposed to be doing. Because there is a tendency of members wanting to dictate how they must work, which we discouraged at all times. Only if they are crime intelligence people, then something strange will be happening if they were to suddenly have to do duty in uniform. Maybe let me, without giving too much, allow General Makgele and General Dio to talk to the footprint of Nyanga, which we are being asked.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, Professor General Jula, welcome.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chair. Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Honorable Members, the National Commissioner. The footprint of Nyanga, the cluster itself, it's 20 members. 20 members. The cluster consists of, it's two clusters that were combined with the merge that consists of plus minus six stations.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Oh, sorry.
Chair, this probably answered my question quite straight. Now, you cluster is six stations and Nyanga, probably you're talking Nyanga, Kukuletu, you're talking Menenberg, you're talking Philippi, you're talking Mitchell's Plain, you're talking quite a huge area and complicated area when you talk about the area that includes the Philippi and the rest. So then your problem is here. Your problem is if you've got six stations and you've got 20 personnel, clearly you have a problem of your footprint in terms of that, in terms of that ratio. So I think this is where it answered my question, Chair. I think that in our discussion and the report process, we'll be able to make some recommendation around this area.
Right. Thank you, members. Is that all the questions on crime intelligence? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I'm happy that he just mentioned 20 members without going too far, because there will be additional capacity in that area, which we can't disclose because they operate in a totally different program. And we also are in the process, having noted the positioning of Nyanga and other stations in the Western Cape within the top 10. The HR people were tasked to review the distribution of personnel in that regard. So the process of revising and adding capacity there, in addition to what we already have, is underway. Chair, I'm going to move on. End in sight, Honorable Groenewald's question. Of course, members are drained. They have been engaged in this for long, and we so wish that the end can be yesterday. But this is it's like a moving target. When we get it right in an area, just as Honorable Mulevati was indicating, the report I got is that now the focus has moved from University of Pretoria to TUT, Tshwane University of Pretoria. But what is encouraging is that the situation is improving, that there are more institutions which have resumed classes. We hope that maybe this is the last push, hoping that come the end of the week we would have arrived there where we want to be, where there is no violence and so on. Our commitment is to continue to deploy and manage the situation. I'm encouraged by the task team that the president has appointed, which will help us to deal with this issue at a different level, while at an operational level we are focusing on. And just on a lighter note, Honorable Ramatlakane, don't be surprised when we come here next year and there is a peak in terms of procurement in that last quarter, because you know, the tear gas, the what do you call, the rubber bullets and everything is being used at a rate that we never anticipated it was going to be used. So it may inform again another spike. The same applies to vehicles. Vehicles and other things, because honorable members will recall the commission, the Marikana Commission, recommended, amongst others, non-lethal weapons. So we are in that process of looking at what is available, and we will continue to procure. And interesting, we continue to be fielding questions on rubber bullets. Rubber bullet is one of those non-lethal weapons. I don't think a stone is non-lethal. On the contrary, the interception, honourable chair, we comply with the laws in this regard. There is a judge that is appointed who is processing our applications, and it is not only ours; it's also of those of our counterparts in the intelligence in environment. There was an issue, Honorable Mbele, that raised on vetting. I think it is long ago that we have a decision taken to ensure that, for example, the senior managers, particularly the lieutenant generals and the national commissioners, vetting is not done by our own crime intelligence, but it's done by state security. The same applies to the crime intelligence people. But because of the capacity and how long it takes, those that we are able to do within the crime intelligence environment, they will be processed. Their vetting is processed. Not that they will not be subjected to a further vetting process by the state security. So that dual process is what is being followed. In any event, Honorable Chair, even if they were to be done by our own people, they all get trained by the same people. Whether they are with us or whether they are with state security, their training, the equipment is the same. So the chances of manipulating are very difficult in that regard. cluster level analysis. I will ask, but before I go to the CI environment, I'm not sure, Honorable Chair, why Honorable Mbele only picked up the one where there is a decrease. Then he should have started by congratulating us in all others where there is an increase. Now we start going and say, but here there is an increase in the number of them. I'm looking at the profiles. We move from 162 to 192, 103 to 131, and so on. And I thought that we have agreed, and I was advised by the honorable members to say, don't look at quantities. So it's not about the how many. It's about the quality of those reports that gets generated and analyzed to inform policing. So for me, it is not necessarily an underperformance in this regard. It is more about the focus of those reports that were generated, Honorable Chair. I think we have covered all, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. Members, we move now to the last program, Program 5. Maybe you must just introduce your delegation, because we don't know that divisional commissioner. It's the first time we see him. We haven't met him before.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I see he went to mobilize the provincial commissioner, because I thought he's busy with operation. Now I see him here. He's coming to protect. Lieutenant General Sithole is the divisional commissioner of protection and security services. In this program, we also deal with the Presidential Protection Unit. Unfortunately, Major General Zala was here, but he took ill, and as a result, Chair, we tender an apology. General Sithole and I will entertain the issues in that environment.
Thank you very much. Let's continue with the presentation.
Honourable Chair, thank you. The last program that we will be presenting is Program 5, that is includes protection and security services. This is also an environment where we only have 7 indicators, and in the previous financial year, the reporting period, we achieved all 7 of those indicators. That represents 100% success rate. In the previous 2 financial years, you will note that we had an 83.3% success rate. But in the last financial year, that went up to 100%, where we have achieved all 7 indicators. The indicators that we're going to focus on is, first of all, you will note, Honorable Chair, that the reporting is split between protection and security services, the division, and then also the presidential protection services, the component, because each of them have very similar indicators, but the focus or the target group is different in terms of the two disciplines. First, the percentage of VIPs provided with security without security breaches from the PSS environment. The target was set at 100% protection. The actual achievement was 100% protection. There was no security breaches as far as that is concerned. The same applies to the percentage of VIPs provided with security without security breaches. As far as presidential protection services is concerned, the target was set at 100%, and the actual performance is also 100%, so with regard to that, we've also achieved the target. The next indicator, the talks to the percentage of security provided at government installations and identified VIP residences without security breaches. First, focusing on protection and security services, the division, the target was set at 100%, the actual achievement 100%, and then as well as the similar indicator for presidential protection, we'll focus on installations and VIP residences. The target was also set at 100% and the actual performance 100%, so in that regard, we did achieve the target. The percentage of national key points and strategic installations audited and evaluated, firstly focusing on protection and security services. The actual target was set at 50% of our strategic installations to be audited. That represents 123 out of a potential 249.
The committee will note that our actual performance was 49% strategic installations, because we did 122 out of a potential of 249. Now, although we were 1 percentage point below the set target, we actually did achieve the target, because there was, in the Northwest Province, what happened is the Department of Local Government and Traditional Affairs closed down, and the two entities merged into one single building, so we did both of them at the same premises. And then the number of strategic installations was adjusted accordingly, and resulting in the targeted 122 installations that were audited. So, as I indicated, here we did achieve the target due to the change in the numbers that we had to audit. The percentage of national key points and strategic installations audited, it's 100% of the national key points to be evaluated. There's 191 was the initial number that we were focused on. The actual performance is 100.52% national key points evaluated. And because during the financial year, the reporting period, an additional national key point was evaluated. So we evaluated 192 from the initial target of 191. So it's one additional national key point that was evaluated. The same indicator for Presidential Protection Services, 100%. The target is also 100%. But with regard to Presidential Protection, we only have three national key points. And there we achieved 84.62% national key points. 11 out of the 13 were evaluated. Now, although the actual number that we evaluated was less than the set target, and it was in the final result is 15.38 percentage points below, we did achieve the target, because one national key point during the assessment period was declassified, and a second national key point, the declassification, was initiated, so we could not evaluate those two national key points. So in terms of the focus of 100%, we did then achieve the target. Now, the number of national key points was then adjusted accordingly. It gives you 11 out of 11. And that concludes Program 5. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Members, let's go to questions. Honourable Mabija, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I understand that there is a national key point declassified and some another one eminent for declassification. And which are those? Which one are those?
Honourable Molobachi, and then Honourable Mbele.
Chairperson, I'm also on national key point. What makes an area qualified to be called a national key point according to the National Key Point Act? And then the next one, what calls for a deregistration of a national key point? And how can that be remedied?
Thank you very much, Honourable Mbele.
Thanks, Chair. I'm covered by the members on that aspect. My other question, well, I suppose broadly, just on the financial front, is to ask what have been the cost drivers that have led to the escalation in expenditure within in particular the VIP protection, because if it had been simply about the expansion of the executive, then there would have been a once-off jump, and then it sort of plateaued, but we've seen ongoing escalations. So just those cost drivers explanation. And then the second one is just to get clarity, because the indicators are broken down between PSS and PPS. Am I correct that the VIPs protected by the PPS are the president and his spouse or spouses, as the case may be. Is there anybody else outside of that? Is it a visiting heads of state when that happens? Who else is covered by the VIP protection of that component? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ramakhani.
No, this program, Chair, I think it's a one that get the A aggregate. It's 100%. So there's not much many questions to it. I just want to find out, Chair, in terms of the static response unit, what's the footprint in terms of rollout in the provinces? Secondly, while I'm on the VIP, I think National Commissioner may have, in some occasion, he was probably privy to our oversight report of the Free State. And now I'm glad to see that General Sithole is now sitting on that chair. Because when we went there and we did the oversight, we found not a Free State VIP unit was living in terrible conditions. Now, I'm only talking Free State because it's where we've been. It may well be that this is a replica of other provinces. We were horrified and we came back in disbelief of the kind of conditions we found. And we, I think in our recommendation, in our report, recommended that the urgent task is something is be done about it. Now, I think General Sithole was heading the delegation when this matter was initially tabled. I will be waiting patiently to hear the response in terms of corrective measures that were implemented in that particular province. I don't even want to go into explanation the condition that we found in that building. And I think that the senior management of SEVS may have also seen that building. Just want to find out what is the update on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Marke. You covered. Thank you, Honourable.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, first I want to ask how many private residences are also protected by the protection services? For instance, I know that former presidents, they have personal protectors, but I specifically want to know whether we talk about private residences, and if we have, how many, and whose residences are we protecting? That's my first question. Chairperson, my second one is, and I've asked this question last year, and it was on the working conditions of the personal protectors, specifically when it comes to the ministers and the deputy ministers. You know, it was a bit of, well, not only reading it in the newspapers, where they actually have to do everything over weekends for the private use of a minister or a deputy minister, and I'm excluding the president here, which is totally unacceptable. We had the former Minister Chabani, who died tragically in an accident where the personal protectors are really speeding. Chairperson, I know what I'm talking about. And I'm telling you, there's not an improvement. You get some of these personal protectors, when they get behind the wheel, they're becoming maniacs. They put on blue lights and they think everybody must just disappear before them. It's dangerous. They are creating a larger, can I say, threat to the person they're supposed to be protected if they're speeding like that. And I've asked that question, what has been done as far as that is concerned? Now, I see that we have mentioned that in our previous report, and although the SAPS provided the response, but it provided the regulatory framework of the VI Group Protection Unit. I wanted specifically on the personal protector, specifically when it comes to the ministers and the deputy ministers, this after hours. I know of incidences where the public, the personal protector actually went home, and then a minister or a deputy minister wants a bread from the cafe, and then he must drive all the way to go and collect this bread for the minister or the deputy minister, which is not acceptable. And I can go on with that, but I know there are certain times that you do not speak out. But I mean, I know the general know what I'm talking about. What are we doing about that? Thank you.
Glad you're only mentioning a bread. Thank you. Keeping it parliamentary. Thank you, members. Let's go to the responses, General.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Honourable members, let General Ravi just talk to the specifics of those, those that are declassified that we are referring to. I think it's 2-2, ne? Let's just provide the detail of that. He will come back to it, Chase, just checking. What makes a point to be declassified? Maybe General Sithole could talk to that one, but I'll give an example. Yeah, let's say the one that was designated as a national key point and now it's no more a national key point. I'll use an example, and I think we were dealing with one now. There is a house that was owned by the late former President Mandela. Now, that house would have been a one of those that are classified, but the house has since been sold, so it's being used for other purposes than the purposes of what would have made it to qualify. So in that case, it then gets declassified, and it's no more a place that we are focusing on. So I'm just using that as an example. Honourable Mbele, the cost drivers. I think there are a variety of cost drivers here. And these drivers are not only informed by whether the executive grows or shrinks. It also has to do with some security consideration, like the aging of the fleet. Then we go into the replacement thereof. So that's one factor which is on an ongoing basis. Secondly, the resource demands, the deployment demands, because in that environment, things like overtime, it's very high on consumption, because let's say the principals, like in when you are here in Parliament, it's never a normal 7-4 responsibility. It stretches, and they will always be there. When they do work outside, so one area which is a very huge cost driver is the compensation budget related, overtime allowances and so on. When it comes to vehicles, again, it's the physical procurement of the vehicles, but it's also fuel maintenance of those vehicles. So really, you can't pin it down to one issue. It's a variety of issues that results in the cost drivers being a little bit high in that environment. I did not understand the one Honorable Ramakakani raised, the one of the static, the footprint or the rollout of the static protection, Honorable Chair.
Ramakakani, if you can just maybe clarify.
The question I was asking in terms of the deployment of auto implementation in terms of provinces. I was asking which provinces has that particular unit that has already been implemented in that particular province. So that was the question, that what's the footprint of it?
I think it's safe to say we have static in all the provinces because we have the division, it's a national division, but we also have got the provincial competency with both close protection and static protection to those facilities and people that qualify for such in terms of the policy. So it is rolled out in all the provinces. May I ask General Sithole to deal with the Free State issue, and by the way, it did not only start when he was leading the delegation. He would have known about it because he comes from there.
Honorable Chair, thanks very much, honorable members. Maybe just to add on the, start by adding on the static, the biggest compliments of static we have in Gauteng and Western Cape. And those are just the two unique provinces. It's because of the Plantarian estate and this site, it's Rondebosch. The Free State, as the Acting National Commissioner directed, I think firstly, we went through the process of acquiring the new building, and that is for the members. And we engaged with Public Works through our national supply chain. The whole process was finalized. We were supposed to have occupied the building as early as last year, June. What happened in Public Works, there were changes in the leadership, and the lease documents got lost. Yes, and as the lease documents got lost, we asked them, because the process was finalized, let's occupy the building. They said, no, there's not yet an authority. And we had to get all the documents, and then we forwarded them back to them so that they start the lease, they process that is the lease. I think just the mid last month, they ask us to write a letter of motivation at clarifying everything so that the current DDG who is assigned to deal with that process would then give us an authority to occupy the building. But basically, the building is not yet occupied. Thank you.
Other responses?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. The two that Honorable Mavicha asked, which ones are they, is the Nelson Mandela House in Houghton and the one in Cape Town. So those are the two houses that are affected. The question of Honorable Groenewald, Honorable Chair, on the private residences, how many of them. I do know that the former presidents continue to enjoy the privileges, as in protection, both close protection as well as static. So we are not withdrawing in terms of the prescripts. We retain their services. I think it is in the main the former presidents, who the president and the deputy president, that continue to enjoy those benefits. And in terms of private residences, even if it is a saving minister, if he or she is not staying in an official, what is it, an official house, where he opts to stay in a private place, if that person falls within the category of those that will qualify for static, we will provide such. But that is only for the duration of his or her term, while serving as a cabinet minister also. And once maybe there are some changes, the rearrangement is being made. Honorable Chair, I've taken note of what Honorable Groenewald raised as working conditions. Ordinarily, there are specific duties that the protectors must perform. Buying bread is not one of them. If it is done, I think it is done on the basis of a gentleman or a lady's arrangement. And that really is something that we continue to discourage, because you also need to give them, resting time, and also time with family. You know that, I think it was early this year or somewhere last year, there are some protectors that went public in the media with regard to how they are treated. We continue to be dealing with such. Where those specifics are made visible to us, the principals are being engaged to try and address the situation. Thanks, Chair.
The report ops first, Honourable Groenewald, then Honourable Ramadlakane, Honourable Mabele Mabija, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Specifically on this, I hear that the General says that it is discouraged, and it's a gentleman's womanly agreement. The fact of the matter is, Chairperson, if the personal protector of a minister, for instance, if the minister put in a request, you won't get that personal, that protector will say, no, I won't do it, because it's their job. It's not their job. But, I mean, politely, they will not refuse to do it. And my question is then, my follow-up is, what communication is there with the executive, specifically as far as the cabinet people are concerned? Let they understand that you cannot ask for a break, because you must just reverse it the other way. The protectors know. It's no obligation to do that. But what communication and interaction is there as far as the ministers and the deputy ministers are concerned, that they must know that they should not, or they can't request such, request them to do certain things? That's the other one. The other one, Chairperson, on the private residences, I hear what the General said, but that's what I want to know. Do we have the figures? Because, you know, the government is spending money to ensure official residences. Let's take, for instance, a minister. One in the south and one in the north, in Pretoria. Now, my question is, I want to know whether we have, or the police have, to supply static protection at private houses where it's not necessary. Because, I mean, the policy should be that the moment you become a minister, then you must use the official residences. That is why the taxpayer had paid for those residences. Why must we have an extra cost providing static protection at private homes? Because the moment you provide static protection at a private house, Chairperson, then it's costs. because then higher walls have to be built and all that sort of things, which is not acceptable. My question is, how many of these, and in fact I also want to have the names of those public persons who have public or private houses and receiving static protection from the police. Thank
you. Honorable Ramatlakane.
No, thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you very much, Commissioner Stoller, for a straight answer. But, you know, I think it's a year later. I don't know whether the VIP unit is still in the same building or whether there's been some other interim arrangement made. It's in the same building. Now, that's where the problem starts, Chair. You know, we went there, we had an oversight there in September last year. September, I think. That's when this matter was escalated. Now it's October. It's a year later, not much has happened. We wrote the report, made the recommendation, and just to get the detail about losing the lease and all the others. Now, I think as Parliament, I would say Parliament, because the committee was there on as an extension of Parliament. We haven't looked at that building, made some proposal and undertakings to those officers that in that building. Now, a year later, we still have not in the same situation. Basically, it's the erosion of credibility of an institution, and an institution is called Parliament. I don't know what else we can do as a committee, but certainly as a committee we must find a way, Chair, to express our displeasure to whoever that's supposed to deal with this, to express our displeasure that the conditions that we saw there is still prevailing today, and we don't see anything in the horizon as to when this will happen, when the solution is going to, problem is going to be alleviated. So I want to make a firm proposal, Chair, that we actually write a letter, the committee expressed, because the document will take long, the finalization of this will take long, that we escalate this issue to the relevant minister about it, that at least the urgent matter, this matter must be addressed quite urgently. I don't know how we look those officers in the face for the condition in which they work for. I don't really know. But I just want to make that proposal that we should do that. And that we must be kept abreast with the new development that is taking place there. That at least we have the most senior officers in this house, in this room, the National Commissioner, that certain things must really happen. Thank you, Chair.
I think on that issue, we will have to do a BRRR recommendation as well. We'll have to do it. Because it's just not acceptable. It's a year later, and now it's problematic. Right, Honourable Berry, you're next.
Thank you, Chair. My one question I don't think was answered concerning the Presidential Protection Service and just getting some clarity on what that covers. And having just taken a quick glance at the report, I think I maybe want to refine my question to make it a bit more pointed, because, I mean, I was right in my assumption that a big chunk of that is protection of heads of state and government when they visit. But then there's mention of 16 presidential dignitaries for in-transit protection during the period under review. as well as mention of 17 VIP residences and four offices by static units, also under the PPS component. And Chair, I would just like some clarity and some detail of what that covers, because it seems like a lot for just the president. So I would like to know what else we're talking about in that arena. Thanks, Chair.
Maybe just to come back to the previous issue, we just checked that was a BRRR recommendation, but the wording said there must be a report at the end of November 2015. There was a report, but I think the problem was follow-up reports or status reports on the issue. So that's maybe a lesson. You know, we need reports until the matter is finalized, but we'll attend to it. Honourable Mabija.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to know if we do this declassification of a point, are there any features that we remove because it's declassified, or we leave everything as is on the point?
When we talk of presidential and deputy presidential presidents' protection, we also include declaration.
I think what we'll have to do, because Honourable Ramadilkani's point is important, we must, for the November oversight visit, we will have to include VIP protection again. Honourable Groenewald.
Thank you, Chair. My last question is that we saw that the President flew to New York on a commercial flight. Now, I want to ask, was that any extra constraints as far as the protection services are concerned towards the President?
Right,
this
members.
The point, of course.
Members, is that all the questions at this stage? Are you sure? Should we vote? Thank you very much, General Pathlane and your team. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, thanks very much. The first difficult question has been asked by Honourable Groenewald, which unfortunately cannot be responded to. The one who is talking about the details of who and so on. Unfortunately, I don't have that information of which minister stays in the official, which one is staying in the private resident. Unfortunately, those details I don't have in my possession. We will have to revert back if it is so required for us to do so.
Sorry, just for clarity on that, the General must understand me correctly. Only where static protection is provided at a private residence. I know there are some of them who stay in private residences, but they don't have the protection there. You have them, some of them who have the. Only where the protection is delivered, that's. Just for clarity for the General.
Chair, I see General Sithole is beginning to answer. Hopefully he's not going to be contradicting me here while I'm busy answering the questions. The floor is yours.
No, thanks, Chair, and thanks, General. I just wanted to clarify the ministerial handbook. That says we protect one resident for a minister, and it doesn't prohibit them. If the minister is staying in an estate, he may decide, I've got security at the estate, you may protect my you can deploy static at my private that is house. So all I'm trying to say is that there's no extra cost that is incurred in protecting any dignitary. And I think the other thing, we may provide information pertaining to where the dignitaries are staying. but part of it is security information. I just wanted to put that one clear because it may compromise security. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Honorable Mbele asked a question, and some of the answers are lying in page 226 in respect of the Presidential Protection Service, 226 of the annual report. But the Presidential Protection looks after the sitting presidents, the sitting deputy president, the former presidents, and the former deputy president. So it is not only relating to the sitting president. And including the visiting presidents of other countries. I think, Honorable Mavija, the question on what features are removed. I don't know what features are now being established by us once, because if it is a private residence, normally in many instances there are no modifications. If, for example, we require, what is it, a house, a smaller, what do you call it, your guardhouse. So they will either be a mobile one, what do you call this, the prefabs, it will either be there, or if it is built, we can't, for example, come back and say, now that we are withdrawing, we are demolishing. Because remember, you would have went through the related processes to go to council, modify the plans and so on. So I think it will impact on the value of that particular house. But I don't think there is too much of a modification which has been done in those facilities. And maybe General Stoller, some other questions that are still to be taken care of?
I think the General has almost answered all the questions. I just wanted to add on the one where the Honorable Member asked what steps are being taken that is in correcting members being sent for private things. I just wanted to add that through your direction, we have introduced the roadshow with all dignitaries, and I personally lead that roadshow. We go sit with them. We explain to them. We start with security awareness. We also explain to them what the complaints that protectors are having. We're doing certain that is things for either ministers and the same, but we also equally afford the dignitaries the opportunity to indicate about the shortcoming of protection and security. So this is ongoing. We visit them individually, but we also go down to premiers. And we then go to lectures and explain to members what is their job description and how should they behave if they are driven out of it. And then there's interaction with us, and then between us and members, and the interaction between us and ministers. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I may have omitted, but I thought there is one.
There is a flight on which General Sithole was a guest.
Oh, General Sithole?
Is it the commercial flight?
No, commercial flight of the...
No, thanks. I think there's a request that we wanna put to the committee, because the request here is that the question is asking for details, and what other additional protection? So our request, that is security information. And it's a high risk for us to relate on such particular information. So maybe my request would be that there's certain information that can rather be shared between the national commissioner or even with the chairperson. But for us to relate on the details of protection and security, it's a national security risk. It's my request. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, no, we must get General Sitoli more often here again, that he understand how this committee works. I'm not asking that he done. My question was, did it incur more security? It's just, I don't want to how many, on what seats that they sit, whether it was 1 Alpha or 13 Delta or whatever. I don't want that. The point I'm making is that because one of the arguments is that it is not viable or feasible for a president to use commercial flights because it incurs more security. So that's what I want to know. Was it in this specific case? Yes or no? So it's not a detailed plan, please.
General Stolle?
The security status, the status quo was maintained, and there was no envisaged threat or need to upgrade the security. Thank you.
Right, thank you very much, honorable members. That is all the questions, all the responses. Thank you very much, members, for the interaction today. Also, thank you to the Acting National Commissioner, General Patlane, and his team for the 2 days, the interaction, and also the spirit in which it was done. I think it is a good step forward, and I think we have taken note of all the responses. We will tomorrow morning, before we meet with CSP, give the committee a breakdown of proposals for BRRR recommendations. Not now. I think the members wants to prepare for tomorrow, so we'll give them opportunity to rest, but we'll tomorrow give indication of draft recommendations, and of course, if members wants to add, you will be very much welcome. We will also want to say to the South African Police Service Management, again, you've got a very important role to play in terms of ensuring stability in the country. We take note of your performance this last few weeks. I think keep up the good work, and also to the members who's taking the extra mile. It's quite important, I think. There is gratitude from the Portfolio Committee and Parliament side for that, because it's, as the Acting Commissioner sometimes say, it's a thankless job. So I think we appreciate that, and it will not be easy also in the next few months to deal with these issues, but we're looking forward also to other interactions in November. We will, of course, in November also invite the Audit Committees of Police to the Portfolio Committee. To ensure, I see there's a conference. Mr. Lobby, please. Thank you. We will also invite the Audit Committee of Police, of course, and to ensure that we get those audit findings sorted out, because it's vital from the Portfolio Committee side that the police service must get a clean bill of health in terms of its compliance issues and financial management. It's essential. While on the one hand, of course, the contribution to the safety and security is critical, police must ensure that it gets its house in terms of administration and financial controls into order. It's vital. There's going to be no compromises from our side. It will also be reflected in our recommendations, but that's why we thought let's also invite the Audit Committee in November to get an extra assurance that the necessary steps is done to ensure that there is compliance. So thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
I'm well, how are you? It's just been a long 2 days.
I look at you and say, how I wish I could acquire the skill, you know, the skill that we are using.
Yes. Can you have a way?
I can.